Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 10th of September, these are our main stories. British MPs have inflicted another Brexit-related defeat on the government, hours ahead of a five-week suspension of Parliament. President Trump says US talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan are dead. US states are beginning an investigation into what they say are anti-competitive practices by Google. Also in this podcast,
the idea is that they'll go and collect the fish from water holes that are basically drying out and the fish would otherwise die and take them to these hatcheries where they'll keep them alive.
An operation is underway in Australia to rescue thousands of fish from sections of one of the country's most important rivers after sections of it dried out because of hot weather. It was a busy Monday evening in the British Parliament at Westminster. British MPs inflicted another defeat on the government in the first of two emergency Brexit debates they squeezed in before Parliament was suspended for 5 weeks. They demanded ministers publish details of their planning for a no-deal Brexit and emails about the decision to suspend or prorogue Parliament. The Conservative MP, Bob Seeley, says he's concerned about the implications of this development.
Government needs to have impartial advice, which is honest, which is clear, and actually government has a very long tradition of not making civil servants' advice necessarily public to members of the House of Commons, because we need to get that advice without fear or favour, without people looking over their shoulders. So actually, I think that members who vote for this should be careful what they wish for and what they vote for.
MPs also debated a call by the opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn for the government to abide by the legislation which compels the Prime Minister to ask the European Union for a three-month extension to the Brexit process if he fails to reach an agreement with the EU. Mr Corbyn told Parliament the Prime Minister should accept the law.
The fact that Parliament is compelled to pass a law to ensure the will of Parliament is upheld shows what extraordinary times we now live in. The House has rejected no deal. Businesses and trade unions are united in rejecting no deal.
Then there was a second attempt by the government to call a general election. The opposition suspects that in Parliament's absence, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson could delay any election to allow a no-deal Brexit at the end of next month. Mr Johnson had this to say to MPs in Parliament.
Mr Speaker, with permission, I beg to move the motion standing in my name under the Fixed Term Parliament Act. Last Wednesday, the Right Honourable Member for Islington North became the first leader of the opposition in the history of our country to show his confidence in Her Majesty's government by declining the opportunity to have an election with a view to removing the government. Though when he spoke last week, it seemed that he might recover his nerve tonight, and I wait to see how he responds. Referring to his surrender bill, he said, and I quote, last week, "Let this bill pass and gain royal assent, and then," he said, "we will back an election." Well, the surrender bill, the Surrender Act has now passed. It has gained royal assent. He has done his level best to wreck this country's chances of a successful negotiation. By his own logic, he must now back an election. And so, Mr Speaker, I am retabling the motion for an early date general election. I don't want an election. I hope this step would be unnecessary. Yet I have accepted the reality that an election is the only way to break the deadlock in the House and to serve the national interest by giving whoever is Prime Minister the strongest possible mandate to negotiate for our country at next month's European Council.
And Boris Johnson added,
"So I say again to everybody on the opposition benches, if you really want to delay Brexit beyond October the 31st, which is what you seem to want to do, then vote for an election and let the people decide. Let the people decide if they want to delay or not. And if you refuse to do that tonight, then I will go to Brussels. I will go to Brussels. Our government will go to Brussels. on October the 17th and negotiate our departure on the 31st of October. Hopefully with a deal, Mr. Speaker, but without one if necessary. I will not ask for another delay.
Meanwhile, a few hours earlier, the Speaker of Parliament, John Bercow, announced he would step down by the end of October.
The least disruptive and most democratic course of action would be for me to stand down at the close of business on Thursday, October the 31st.
John Bercow. So, to understand all the drama at Westminster, the BBC's Ritula Shah spoke to our political correspondent Jessica Parker at Westminster and asked her, was it a case of a race against time for Parliament to complete its business before it shuts up shop?
Well, in a sense, yes, because we've seen Dominic Grieve try and push through his motion demanding that communications around the prorogation of Parliament be published and the Yellowhammer documents. We've seen Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, trying to make his point as well, demanding that ministers abide by the rule of law. But also, in a sense, no, because any overhanging business legislation will just have to simply be dropped, possibly to be picked up again at a later date. But I think certainly over this last week, we've seen this big rush by MPs, cross-party MPs, galvanised to try and pass their bill, which they have done successfully. It was confirmed as law today, to try and stop a no-deal Brexit. For Boris Johnson, I think, this last week has been a rush of successive defeats. From his perspective, this Parliament isn't exactly doing his bidding, although I think there is the view that might feed into this narrative that he's trying to defend Brexit against unruly MPs.
A lengthy break, there'll be the party conferences, but it's also an opportunity for the government to keep putting out its messages without any real scrutiny. How much concern is there about that in this very divided Parliament?
Well, certainly there won't be parliamentary scrutiny because Parliament isn't sitting, although other types of scrutiny, I'm sure, will continue. And yes, it's conference season, so actually it'll mean all the parties, to some extent, get their turn to showcase their plans and showcase their policies, make big set-piece speeches. But of course, the other thing that conferences can do is expose tensions on policy and personality as well. But I'd also add, don't think for a moment that the other parties don't know that a general election is probably coming around the corner. Probably a chance over the next few weeks for them to get their message out as well.
Jessica Parker at Westminster. Other news now. The US President Donald Trump says talks with the Afghan Taliban are dead. He was speaking to reporters in Washington 2 days after abruptly cancelling a previously unannounced meeting with Taliban leaders at the presidential retreat at Camp David. From Washington, here's Gary O'Donoghue.
The president said on social media he was revoking the invitation because the militants had killed a US serviceman in a car bomb attack. President Trump said the US was hitting the Taliban harder than ever before, but the autumn usually sees an easing of hostilities with the end of the fighting season. As for US troops, President Trump has long promised to bring them home. That wish to cut US numbers in Afghanistan, particularly with a general election in America next year, may mean the Taliban believes it doesn't have to return to the negotiating table in a rush.
Gary O'Donoghue. Staying in the US, legal officers have announced a collective investigation into allegedly anti-competitive practices by the search giant Google. Separate inquiries into Facebook, Amazon and Apple are already underway in America. The BBC's Samira Hussain was outside the Supreme Court in Washington.
We've seen a coalition of some 50 state attorney generals, so state officials. We're talking about Republicans and Democrats that are coming together to really try and investigate some of Google's practices. What they're saying is that this is an initial investigation to try and get at whether or not they are using their dominance to stifle any more kind of competition. There's just a lot more pressure being put on big tech by various levels of government, not just at the state level, but of course, there are still ongoing investigations by the Department of Justice and by the Federal Trade Commission.
Samir Hussain in Washington. Now to Japan, where the boss of the troubled Japanese carmaker Nissan is stepping down after admitting that he received $500,000 more pay than he was entitled to. Hiroto Saikawa's resignation is another problem for the firm after its former head, Carlos Ghosn, was arrested last year for underreporting his salary. Nissan said Mr. Sakawa's overpayment was grave but not illegal. Mr. Sakawa says he's willing to give back the excess funds.
And of course, the issue that I caused you concern over, that of the stock appreciation rights scheme. We've investigated this, and the result is that I've proposed to return the amount that I wasn't meant to receive. I think this has brought the matter to an end.
I asked our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker, what else Nissan had said.
Well, the board has issued a statement. They said that they had asked Mr. Sakawa to resign his position as chief executive of the company, effective from the 16th of September, that's a week today, and he accepted. He agreed to do that. They also said they'd received a report into the affair, which also looked at the allegations surrounding Carlos Ghosn, who you mentioned, the previous chairman, and another director. And in that report, it said that Mr. Sakawa had made a request to another director to explore ways to increase his remuneration. And what actually happened was that this other director falsified documents to give the appearance that Mr. Sakawa's stock options, share options, had been exercised on a different date, with the effect of giving him this additional remuneration of $500,000. Nissan say that they don't believe that Mr. Sakawa or some other executives who are in similar situations were unaware of the improper methods that were used, and so they're not planning to treat him or the other individuals as benefiting from the improper actions that were taking. And Mr. Ghosn and Greg Kelly, the director of whom these requests were made, is another matter. They are being treated quite differently. I should say that both those individuals, Ghosn and Kelly, deny any wrongdoing.
And Nissan's had quite a torrid time lately, hasn't it? Because they announced, thousands of job losses in July.
Yes, indeed. And the share price has plummeted, and there have been a number of disappointments for shareholders in terms of the company's profits. And it's worth emphasising, I think, that the motor industry globally is having a pretty rough time. There are issues about the weakness of international trade that they've been affected by. And there's also the big long-term challenge of trying to deal with the transition to more electric cars. Having said that, Nissan has got some very particular problems, and the new chief executive, who they hope to have in place by the end of next month, is really going to have his, or I suppose conceivably her, work cut out.
Andrew Walker. North Korea has announced its willingness to resume nuclear talks with the United States, which have been stalled for more than 6 months. The deputy foreign minister said they could begin later this month, but she warned that Washington would have to bring forward new proposals. As Pyongyang was making the announcement, South Korea hosted a concert along the heavily fortified demilitarized zone, which separates it from North Korea. It was a celebration of the first anniversary of the joint Pyongyang declaration adopted by the leaders of the two Koreas, which aimed to end military hostility and to boost cooperation. Our correspondent Laura Bicker was at the concert.
For the world-renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma, this performance is a dream come true. He told the audience that he's always wanted to play here, at the border between the two Koreas.
Culture allows us to dream together. And together, we can achieve the impossible.
The concert's on a makeshift stage at Dorasan train station, the last stop in the south. Beyond here lie lines of barbed wire, fields of landmines. It's called the Demilitarized Zone, but it's the most heavily fortified border in the world and separates two countries which are technically still at war. Just last year, there were discussions to change all that. In September 2018, South Korea's President Moon and North Korea's Kim Jong-un declared to work together towards disarmament, an historic agreement that many believed would usher in a new era for these two countries after nearly 70 years of false starts and false hopes. The two sides destroyed watchtowers, removed landmines, The South has created nature walks and called them peace trails, taking tourists further into the DMZ than ever before. But in recent months, harsher signals have come from Pyongyang. They've tested missile after missile, new weapons which could target the South. In June, there was a surprise meeting between Donald Trump and Mr. Kim at the DMZ.
The relationship that we've developed has meant so much to so many people.
Each month since, the US has said more substantial talks will follow in the coming days or weeks. But there's been nothing. So as crowd-pleasing as this concert may be, is it all in vain?
If we keep trying, I believe one day we will be unified.
I don't think unification will be easy. Will it come peacefully?
For some, the dream continues. There are those in the South who cling to the hope that these voices will carry over the border, and that even if the North isn't talking, someone there is at least listening.
That report by Laura Bicker in South Korea. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Hello. Where has your life taken you?
It's kind of an adventure.
Did you expect to end up where you are now?
I really believe that I'm making some change.
The documentary podcast from the BBC World Service takes you to surprising and unexpected places.
People are afraid to use the road
at night.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened to the people in our new series of shows.
That's the road we're walking back on.
Yeah.
My name's Asif Kapadia, and I'm the presenter of Detours, produced in collaboration with Sundance Institute. We'll meet Greeks sending dead relatives over the mountains to Bulgaria.
I ask sometimes the body, what kind of music do you like?
Wild elephants forced off their feeding paths in Assam, India.
How can one relax when there's an elephant just outside your homestead?
People on the move from Africa seeking better lives in the USA.
How many people do you share a tent with?
10 people. Yeah, 10 people are sharing the tent, yeah.
A young Rohingya man stuck on an island in the Pacific.
Have I committed any crime? No. I'm just trying to save my life.
And a Macedonian medical student writing fake news for a living.
We know what's wrong, but sometimes in our country, the wrong is the only way to survive.
That's Detours on the documentary podcast from the BBC World Service.
We're passing by life, you know. We're here now and then we're not.
Just search for The Documentary wherever you get your podcasts.
Rescue workers in the Bahamas are continuing to search for survivors of Hurricane Dorian, which battered the islands 9 days ago, leaving terrible devastation. 45 people have been confirmed dead, but hundreds are still missing. The country's health minister has rebutted claims by some residents that they've seen little sign of an official response to the disaster. Our correspondent Ali McBull has been to Abaco, one of the worst affected areas.
Now the airport on Abaco has been cleared of debris. It's a chaotic scene of people trying to get off the island that was so devastated by Hurricane Dorian. People like Petra Russell.
There's nothing left. There's nothing to do, so all you can do is try find better, because everything is gone.
Drive through the town of Marsh Harbour close by, and there's not a structure standing as far as the eye can see, particularly in the Haitian shanty town there.
When the hurricane passed, some people, they don't have time to move.
In there was the home of Ebner Francois. We were going to accompany him back to the spot for the first time, but when he got to the edge of the town, he froze.
Why don't you want to go there?
You could smell, you don't know what you smell there. Look like some people is still in there. There are plenty of people dead. Plenty of people dead.
Among the ghosts here for Ebner is that of his girlfriend, Lisa. Her body was found, but the stench Ebner talks of suggests many still haven't been.
I got 3 of them died. They're still in there.
They didn't find the bodies?
No.
Ebner survived with her children, though she lost 2 fingers in the storm, stopping a door hitting her daughter. But 3 of her cousins are still missing. She's reluctant to fly out to the Bahamian capital, Nassau.
They tell people go Nassau. I don't know nothing about Nassau because I ain't get no family in Nassau to live because my kids need to go to school. But I ain't get nothing. I lost all my things. I ain't get nothing in my life.
It is the poorest who've been affected most by the hurricane, mainly from Abaco's Haitian community. Many of them feel the prospects are bleak, whether they stay or go.
Ali McBull in the Bahamas. In China, there's a growing debate about whether traditional gender roles are beginning to change when it comes to family life. For the past few days, more than 11,000 people have used the hashtag men born in the 90s more willing to raise kids on the Chinese social media site Weibo. For more, I spoke to our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
It all started with a video that was put out by Pear Video, who were very popular amongst young people in China. They put out these nice little video packages about things that change in Chinese society. They noticed some statistics which mentioned that increasingly people born after the 90s were looking into having a child, and they decided they wanted to go out and interview people and noticed that for the first time there were more men with young children than there were women. Because it used to be the case in Chinese society that you would always see very, very young children with their mothers. You would never see them with your fathers because the traditional breadwinners of the family were the men in China. But obviously with changes now, with development in Chinese society, there are increasingly more women entering into long-term employment and they're choosing to have children later.
Do you think this is a genuine discussion or is there any sense of government involvement in it?
There could be government involvement, definitely, because the government has been getting increasingly concerned in recent months that women are no longer having children, or if they are having children, they're having them much later. So it's trying to offer incentives so that women can feel that they can have it both. They can have a child, but they can also stay in employment. But people have increasingly been saying on social media that they're choosing no longer to get married. They'd rather just focus on work and lifestyle, and they don't want to be tied down to the idea of having a child. So the idea that more men might actually be involved in the parenting rather than women taking on a lot of the domestic responsibilities and having a job could be seen as something that's actually quite appealing to a lot of young Chinese women.
So does China's one-child policy play into this as well? Because people, they are allowed to have more than one child now, aren't they? But I suppose a lot of these 90s men will be the only children in their family.
Absolutely, yes. And also because during the one-child policy, it was preferred to have a male child so that you could continue the family line. There's now a situation where the boys that were born under the one-child policy have grown up and there are millions more men than there are women. So many can't find a partner. So this has also played into the fact that many people can't get married simply because they can't actually meet anybody. So the government is looking at ways that it can try and encourage men to have children. And it might be a case that single parenting for men is something that traditionally you'd never hear about, but actually could be quite a favourable trend moving towards in China.
Kerry Allen. Now, you might have seen a video on BBC Online entitled Being Mixed Race Means I Could Die. It's a moving story about a Nigerian-German woman, Astrid, who's suffering from leukemia and is desperately looking for a stem cell donor. The problem is that there are very few mixed race donors in the world. Luke Jones heard more from Olivier Le Poitevin, who edited that video.
My story with Astrid basically began with an email that a colleague forwarded to me. You know, this campaign of hers was gaining traction in Germany, and I decided to look into her story and also the realities of people around the world who are mixed race. And I was pretty startled, actually, by the data that I found, you know, showing that, for example, if you're a mixed race and you need a stem cell donor, well, only 3% of donors worldwide are mixed race. And basically, I took it from there, and I've been working with Astrid for about 5 months now. She's been doing, like, daily video diaries, essentially tracking her journey as she goes through treatment, as she goes through an exhausting attempt to, you know, go throughout the world to find a donor. You know, her campaign's been to Nigeria, it's been throughout Europe and also the US. And essentially, I decided to make this video, I guess, as, you know, to raise awareness, not just also about her story, but the fact that thousands of people around the world right now are being affected by this issue.
Well, let's have a little listen of what she had to say.
Cancer means getting to know the dark side of life. Cancer triggers anxiety.
I had the feeling it was a joke. There's no way it's leukemia. Not being able to see my children grow up is unbearable to me. I want to prepare my children for life, not death.
Around 30 million donors worldwide have been registered. They are predominantly white. If you take two populations, take a Chinese population, take the Central European population, there are clear differences in all their markers, and they make a procedure between ethnic populations difficult.
As yet, there is not worldwide a single person who would closely match me.
And Olivia, what have people been saying in response to hearing Astrid's story?
Well, the reaction's been pretty tremendous. The video's had nearly 2 million views now. And we've had so many comments, for example, from this person in South Africa. She said, "Hey, I've seen the video. I was so touched. I'm South African. My daughter and I both want to help." And she subsequently is now signed up as a donor. We also heard from one woman in the Caribbean called Abby. She said, "This story hits real close to home, even if there's a continent and ocean between us. Like Astrid, I have leukemia. And like Astrid, I am a black woman of mixed heritage. My motivation to face treatment fearlessly came from my wish to be present to raise my children. All the best to Astrid."
Olivia Le Poitevin from BBC Minute. An operation is underway in Australia to rescue fish from sections of one of the country's most important rivers. Fish that have become stranded in isolated pools of the River Darling in New South Wales will be caught and transported elsewhere. High temperatures, low rainfall and the extraction of too much water meant the river dried up in a number of places last year, leading to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of fish. Henry Beller reports.
The Murray-Darling Basin is the biggest and most important river system in Australia, travelling from the nation's north through agricultural heartland to the South Australian coast. In recent years, it's been ravaged by drought. Water levels are extremely low, made worse by heavy irrigation. This is bad news for farmers and small towns dependent on the river, but also for native fish. During summer heatwaves, water temperatures in these shallow riverbeds spike. Blue algae grows quickly in the heat, and this sucks oxygen from the water, suffocating fish. That's exactly what happened earlier this year, when shocking images of thousands of dead fish sparked public outrage and now action from politicians accused of mismanaging the river. Dr. Fran Sheldon from the Australian Rivers Institute says the New South Wales government will spend millions of dollars to avoid another mass kill.
The idea is that they'll go and collect the fish from waterholes that are basically drying out and the fish would otherwise die, and take them to these hatcheries where they'll keep them alive, and hopefully when the river starts to flow again, they'll put the fish back into the ecosystem.
This scheme may save hundreds of fish, but it's unlikely to solve the underlying causes of the river's deterioration, like climate change and a political fight over how to manage a river that spans six separate jurisdictions. That's why some locals are dismissing this as a short-term fix for a river system that will need an immense amount of work to repair.
That report by Henry Bellow. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.